welcome to you, faithful listeners and unfaithful listeners and new listeners. You are all welcome. This is the hashtag STRAS podcast.
If they're unfaithful, they're probably not going to be listening.
Well, they just happen to be listening to this one.
Oh, okay.
And we're glad you're here. We're glad you're here for this one. I'm Amy Hall, and this is Greg Kokel, and I'm going to ask him a question that we received on Twitter with the hashtag STRAS.
Got it.
So here we go. This first one comes from Kevin. What is a Supreme Court justice morally obligated to do if he slash she encounters a case that requires a constitutional judgment that is against what the Bible would require?
Well, according to their oath, they are to uphold the Constitution of the United States. And if the Constitution provides latitude for a ruling that encourages and increases directly, not just as some kind of spin-off consequence, because lots of laws do that, but as a direct conclusion, immorality or vice or I was going to say some hostility or violation of religious liberty, but that would be inconsistent with the Constitution. So, but if the circumstance occurred that you just described, Amy, then that justice is required to recuse themselves. In other words, they say, I'm opting out. I'm not going to participate in this, because now they have conflicting loyalties. They have conflicting obligations. Their sworn obligation, so help me God, is to defend, uphold, I'm trying to think of the exact words, but it's something like uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. Now, there are massive numbers of public officials for which that is complete lip service, because so much of what they do in public office, and even jurists, those on the on SCOTUS, Supreme Court of the United States, just ignore that, and they don't do what the Constitution says and avoid doing what it doesn't say. They do what they want, and then they pretend that it's in the Constitution. This is one value to having a conservative justice, and I don't mean politically conservative at all. You can have a liberal justice, one who has liberal political views, who understands that the Constitution does not allow them to adjudicate from the bench, and therefore they're not going to have their judgments have the force of law if it's not in support of the Constitution. And so a Christian in the circumstance that you just described, or anyone, quite frankly, if they have strong convictions one way about what is good and right and true, and the Constitution requires that they judge inconsistently with their convictions, then it is appropriate for them to recuse themselves so they do not clash in their convictions. They just remove themselves for that judgment from the circumstance. And that's a way of avoiding both of the problems. In a certain sense, it's not a moral dilemma. A moral dilemma is when you're stuck between two options and you must choose one of the two. And when you do that, you choose the greater good, and then you've done the right thing. But in the case of the Supreme Court justice, they have a third option, and that is to recuse themselves and just not participate. Although I have a hard time understanding how that could actually happen, because the Constitution broadly protects legitimate liberties. The Constitution proper, okay? The Constitution proper, as opposed to the Bill of Rights, is a structure for how government is run, okay? It's just a structure. Here's how things work, all right? And then you have the Bill of Rights that guarantees certain liberties to people and rights and liberties. And it's the 14th Amendment, which is the amendment that says that there should be equal rights under the law, or equal application of the rights. That's the one that gets abused, because people think, well, if we have equal application of all the rights, then gays should be married, for example. Gays should allow to have official, legitimate, government-sanctioned marriages, because Or I should say same-sex partners should, because it doesn't matter about their sexual preference. It matters about their gender, which is ironic because there's no such thing as gender anymore, even in the political system. But anyway, you get the point there. I don't think there's a problem. Someone keeping their oath to the Constitution will not have a problem keeping fidelity to Christ.
Yeah, Greg, I was just opening my mouth to say that.
Sorry.
When you said that, this is completely, it's just hypothetical, because our Constitution doesn't demand anything that the Bible prohibits. Defending, like you said, defending our natural rights is something that any judge who's a Christian could agree with. And I also agree with you, Greg, if at some point our Constitution was amended to the point where now our Constitution said something like, let's say it enshrined the right to abortion, for example, they actually put an amendment in the Constitution. At that point, I would no longer be able to defend the Constitution. So, I mean, unless you were to, I mean, I don't know how they would do anything to fix that, but because it obviously contradicts earlier parts of the Constitution. But if that were to happen, I guess I would step down as a judge. But in general, a Supreme Court judge is not creating laws or enforcing laws. They're merely saying, does this law contradict what the Constitution says? Now, even so, for example, let's say somebody said this is a good thing for them to enforce these freedoms. So let's say a justice said this person has a right to false worship. I don't think that's against what the Bible teaches for the judge to uphold the freedom for someone else to falsely worship.
God upholds that freedom.
Right.
In a certain sense, yeah.
Yeah, so that would be an example of where you would be upholding something you disagree with as a Christian, but it's not wrong for a judge to maintain that liberty for everyone that Christians also enjoy.
Yeah, but think about it. Yeah, but strictly speaking, what you would be upholding is the principle of freedom of religion.
Right.
You are not affirming the false religion, you are affirming the freedom.
Right.
And that's a freedom that protects us as well. So I'm just wondering, though, you made a comment that even if we had an amendment to the Constitution, say, so that the right to abortion was explicit in an amendment, but it would, you said they couldn't happen because it contradicts earlier parts of the – but the point of an amendment is to change the Constitution, whatever it says earlier. You can't have an unconstitutional constitutional amendment.
Well, I don't think any amendment has changed what they've said earlier. They've merely added explicit new things.
That's
like,
true.
Yeah.
But I was just simply – it expanded the rights of the Constitution, like voting rights to blacks, voting rights to women. The Bill of Rights were already understood that they were going to be part of the Constitution. And if there's no Bill of Rights, then the Constitutional Convention would not have passed the Constitution to begin with. They knew that there were more things that were going to be built in, you know, like the first freedoms, freedom of religion, freedom to bear arms, the first five.
So there are some things that the Constitution didn't originally make explicit, say, for example, voting rights – to expanding voting rights to everyone, but it didn't prohibit those voting rights either.
Correct.
So going from saying that, equal protection of the law to saying this whole class of human beings we can kill in the Constitution, that would be an example of contradicting something earlier.
Yeah.
So I don't even know how that would work, but I'm sure they would define words certain ways so that you could do that. I don't even know how that would work, Greg. If an amendment is passed that contradicts something earlier in the Constitution, what would happen?
Well, then the earlier thing would be amended, struck, basically made rendered useless or inert for the sake of the amendment. So you're right. Most of the amendments have simply added rights. Okay, it's all part of the extended Bill of Rights, and extended privileges. You know, it's interesting. I think about the right of the women to vote and the right of men to vote. That is not a change to the Constitution. It is a clarification of because there was a right to vote. You know, just generally, I mean, here's how this worked. And then it was the states that decided who got to vote. And then when it was clear that this was that the Constitution did not go far enough, then you have an amendment to the Constitution to make it clear that women and blacks get the right to vote. And the Constitution didn't say blacks can't vote. And by the way, this goes to an issue of arguing for the living Constitution because things have changed. If we go back to the original intent, they'll say is, well, these were white men that never intended women to vote or blacks to vote or whatever. Okay. Well, I don't know that that's the case. They just didn't clarify or specify that. It was open-ended. All right. And then how did you adjust that? You didn't adjust that by five justices being activists on the bench. You amend the Constitution by a means by which the Constitution allows. And it's very hard to do. You need 2/3 of the states. You need a supermajority in the Senate. It's hard to amend. Unless you have five activist justices, and then they can de facto amend it like they did with Roe versus Wade or the Obergefell case, which they found a right for same-sex couples to marry, which it's not in there because the word marriage doesn't even mean same-sex couples.
Right. That was all a question of definition because everyone had the right to marry. Everyone, nobody was denied the right to marry. The question was, what does marry mean? What does that mean? And so they changed the definition by fiat, by the justices.
By fiat, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Okay, we've said enough about that.
I'll just throw it out there. If you go to our website and look up understand the same-sex marriage issue, you can read about all these. You can read more about this because there's certainly a lot to say about that also.
Right. And keep in mind when the Constitution, when it doesn't matter actually which section of humanity or what period of time until just very recently, when people build constitutions, they are building constitutions based on their perception of reality. And so our Constitution was built based on the nature of reality. The nature of reality is that human beings are heterosexual, and that's what it takes to reproduce. And this is why they protect particular relationships, because they produce the next generation by nature. And as a rule, so there are exceptions. Some married couples don't, heterosexual couples don't have children, but that's, you don't make the rule by the exception. You make the rule by the rule. And so this was just the very nature of reality. And so when there's equal protection under the law, 14th Amendment, no one imagined that someone would act as if there was something contrary to the nature of reality. Why don't we say, well, equal protection, then human beings should be allowed to marry their schnauzer, for goodness sake. They have a right to marry whoever they want or whatever they want. Why not? I mean, that's ridiculous because marriage isn't between human beings and animals. That's not a word that even applies that way in the same with same-sex marriage. But that's a fait accompli. It's all done with for the moment. And that will never be overturned because too many people are married now that are same-sex.
Yeah, everyone has a – we've gotten on a different subject. But everyone has a definition of marriage. Everyone was promoting a definition of marriage. It wasn't that some people said everyone can marry anything or anyone. Nobody said that. Everyone either – you know. If you were saying same sex, you were saying it's only two people. So it was very disingenuous to pretend like they were the ones who were voting for freedom and everyone marrying who they want. No, they were just voting for a change in definition, and that was never made clear, I don't think.
Right.
But anyway, I there's a lot more about this on our website if you're interested. But let's go on to a question from Jared Bolas. I recently discussed pacifism with a Christian friend whose chief argument in favor of it is that we are commanded to love our enemy, i.e. violence of any kind is impermissible in all circumstances. Is this a proper way of understanding this command?
Oh, we are also commanded to love our neighbor. So how are we loving our neighbor when we are standing there watching an evil person destroy an innocent person. We stand there and watch that. And so what we are doing when we, let's just say, I think you might call this a moral dilemma, where we have to love our enemy, but we have to love our neighbor too. Which one do we choose? Oh, this person, the pacifist says, we're going to love our enemy to the expense, we're going to love our wicked enemy to the expense of our innocent neighbor. That's what we're going to do. All right. And I think Jesus is talking about an attitude and how to deal with enemies in our lives. He is not saying that war is immoral. And the reason that war is not immoral, which is why there are many, many wars in the Bible that God himself ordained. So obviously this could not be a sin if God himself ordained it, is because there are wars that are just and appropriate. The Second World War, I'm reading right now through The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich. It's a tough read. It's fascinating, but it's 1,300 pages. And there you've got evil that it's hard to countenance the kind of evil that totalitarian regime produced. Now, it turns out that the Chinese and the Russians are just as bad, but they don't have the records the Germans had. Who were really good at record keeping, so we know the names of everybody they obliterated. 6 million Jews, but we've killed more than 6 million children here since in Roe v. Wade since 1973. So it's like we're no better than the Nazis in this country in terms of destroying innocent human life. But now I try. I'm losing my train of thought. That's why I'm chuckling here. Where was I going with this, Amy?
Well, you were just talking about how it's World War II was just.
Oh, yeah. Peace. Yeah. Pacifism. So it was completely legitimate for us to fight the Nazis. And the issue of loving your enemies did not enter in the same way. I don't think God and Jesus intended it to do that way. Now, it might have an impact on how we prosecute the war and how we deal with prisoners and stuff like that. But to stop someone who is violently destroying or harming another human being, innocent human being, is somehow a violation of love. To not stop is a violation of love. You're not loving your neighbor. I don't understand how people are even persuaded by this line of thinking when they countenance what it involves. We stand there and watch innocent people be butchered when we could do something about it. We choose not to because we're so loving? Really?
Yeah, I think a big reason why people misunderstand this, Greg, is because they don't understand that there is a role for an individual and there's a role for government. There's a biblical role for government. If you go to Romans 13, and I think we touched on this about a month ago when somebody was asking about taking legal action against somebody, but the government stands in the place of God to express God's wrath against sin. That's explicitly in actually the end of Romans 12 and the beginning mm-hmm. of Romans 13. Mm-hmm. So it says the government, they do not bear the sword for nothing. Mm-hmm. They're expressing God's wrath against
the
sin.
Sword.
That is their, that exactly, the sword. That is their role. They are standing in the place of God to do that role. I am not, as an individual, I do not have the right to go to my enemy and prosecute some sort of wrath against them. That's not my role. So I think that's who Jesus is talking to. He's talking to mainly to people who are seeking their own revenge. Again, this is at the end of Romans 12. Don't seek your own revenge. Leave room for the wrath of God. And how does God express that wrath in this life is through governments.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the point. But what you said about prisoners, Greg, I thought was really a good point. And I think about the prisoners in World War II. They were treated, the German prisoners were treated really well.
Yeah, they had it better than in Germany.
Yeah, so that is a great example. That's where you're dealing with an individual and, you know, you're treating them well. So.
You know, there's a great a movie that exemplifies this point. It's called the Green something or other, Tom Hanks.
Green Mile.
The Green Mile, yeah, where you have a gracious guard who is played by Tom Hanks, and he, you can see how these men are being punished justly for terrible things that they did, but he, somewhat alone, is the one who is treating them with the dignity and respect that's due them as human beings made in the image of God. So. I was thinking about one other thing. You mentioned the role of government as the hand of wrath to punish evil properly. They don't bear the sword for nothing, and the sword wasn't for spanking. Okay. But when it comes to an individual circumstance, if I see one person harming another person, okay, that other person, the bad person in this, is not my enemy. It's the enemy of the person who's being harmed. You know, and so if I love them, I love them at the expense of the innocent person being harmed. So that maybe the simplest way of thinking about this is just thinking about it as a moral dilemma with competing moral obligations. Love your enemy and love your neighbor. All right. So love your neighbor means seeking the good of the neighbor. All right. So when you have a circumstance where a bad person is hurting an innocent person, okay, you have a obligation to love the bad person and an obligation to love the innocent person. This is not a difficult moral dilemma to solve. And if anybody says, well, I think the weight of the morality is on the side of the bad person and too bad for the innocent person, that person has a broken moral compass.
Yeah. And in a case where you were seeing some, let's say you see somebody, about to murder somebody else on the street, and you have a way to stop it.
Even lethal. If it might even require lethal.
Right. In that resistance. Case, you are acting under the I would say you're acting in a way that the law would allow.
Right.
And so you're not going out on your own to get revenge on somebody. I think that's different than protecting somebody.
I never thought of that, but this also falls under the legal and appropriate use of the law. The law allows you to defend somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Then one other...
And yourself, for that matter.
Yeah, yeah. So one other thing I wanted to point out in Luke, just as a indication of whether or not it was immoral to be, say, in the military. When John the Baptist first, in Luke 3, John the Baptist is talking to the crowd, and the crowds are saying, well, what should we do to repent and live the way God wants us to live?
Mm-hmm.
And then it says, some soldiers were questioning him, saying, and what about us? What shall we do? Now, if pacifism were what God required, John would say, you need to leave your profession, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that makes sense. But what he says is, do not take money from anyone by force or accuse anyone falsely and be content with your wages. He says nothing about it being wrong for them to be soldiers. Right. And I think that's a good indication that it's not.
Well, excellent point. Yeah, don't abuse your power. And by the way, for the fact that many of the early Christians were they refused to join the military, all right? And some mistakenly take that to mean conclude from that that the Christians were pacifists. That isn't why they refused to join the military. If you joined the military, you had to take an oath to Caesar as a god. It was an act of idolatry, and out of fealty to Christ, they wouldn't do that, and they suffered as a result.
Well, thank you, Greg, and thank you, Kevin and Jared, for your questions. We always love hearing from you all. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.